courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand.
You hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUS Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
From the Wall Street Journal, this is Instant Message. I'm David Pierce. This is a show about what's happening in tech and what it all means for you. If this is your first time listening, here's how the show works. In a minute, I'm going to bring in my colleagues, Christopher Mims and Joanna Stern, and we'll talk about the biggest news and topics on our minds. This week, it's a topic you'll hear us talk about a lot, our relationships with technology. And we're going to check in on what's going on at Facebook, which has had a very tumultuous year. And ahead of the midterm elections in the U.S. next week is back in the news. After that, Joanna has our weekly upgrade, something quick and easy you can do to make your tech life better. This week, her recommendation is to go all reverse Wizard of Oz on us or something. I don't really know. We'll see. Lastly, every week, we spend a few minutes digging a little deeper into a particular topic or person that matters right now in the tech world. This week, I talked to Clay Bavor and Aparna Chennapragada, who run Google's augmented and virtual reality team. Their job is to take those things from nifty tech demos to actual things for actual people. Stay tuned for that. But okay, let's get rolling. Joining me now, Christopher Mims over Skype from Baltimore and Joanna Stern in our New York studio. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
We sound better this time. And you're not on Skype, Christopher Mims. You're on Zoom because we're just trying all kinds of crazy things here.
Zoom, which is the new Skype.
Let's try Facebook Messenger next week. And then let's try FaceTime.
Group chat just happened. If everybody upgrades to the latest iOS, we'll get end-to-end encrypted group chat.
Do you work for Apple?
Just living the dream.
Christopher, do you start working at Apple? Not tell us.
Okay, so let's just dig in here. So, and actually, to your point about iOS, I have a question for both of you that I have been wondering for a while. And this is not super newsy because it's actually a couple of months since these things launched. But we've now had screen time features and digital wellness stuff. And I have a new gadget that is meant to do sort of the same things that they do, which is basically like help you control yourself as you use technology. Have you guys used these features yet? I've been wondering if I'm just the only person who is not suddenly better at using technology because now my iPhone will yell at me about it. Are you guys using them? Have you found use out of these features?
Yeah. So I wrote about screen time when it first came out, officially came out in September to everyone, but I've been using it since July when the beta came out for iOS 12, and it has not helped me one single bit. Really, this is just the phone telling you that you've been on your specific apps or you've been on your phone for a certain amount of time. And so you can set limits or locks and say, I only want to be on Twitter for an hour a day. I only want to be on Instagram for 30 minutes a day. And it will shut those down after that period of time. And it will actually like put a little lock icon on the icon. So you can't, when you tap in, it says like, you can no longer, you've exceeded your limit for the day. You can override it or you can say, okay, I'm not going to use this anymore.
And you've gotten nothing out of this. Like for me, been basically that I see these things. I set Instagram at 30 minutes, and part of it was like, I have no idea how long I use these apps for anyway. So I was just like, what if I only do 30 minutes of Instagram? I probably never do it that much. And I hit it every single day. And all it does is make me feel sort of vaguely bad about myself for like 2 seconds while I hit the extend time button. And then I go right back to using Instagram. And I don't feel like anything about it has changed, except it's slightly more annoying to use Instagram now.
That's exactly been my experience for the last number of months using it. And when I spoke to Apple and I spoke to some experts around how we should use these tools, I mean, to your point, you don't really know how long you've spent on it. And so that's one of the nice things about screen time. And same thing for Google's well-being, which is only on a select number of phones right now. But you can dig into the settings and see how long you're spending on each app every day. And it gives you sort of a nice summary of how long you spend on your phone, how long you spend in certain types of apps or like categories of apps. So social networking, productivity, et cetera. And so they suggest you do that for a couple of weeks, and then you start to say, okay, well, I spend an hour on Instagram every day. I'm going to try and put in 50 minutes so I can bring it down just a little bit. And so it's sort of about like those small victories. In fact, I spoke to Arianna Huffington about this. She's now a proclaimed smartphone addiction expert. And
she just wants you to sleep all the time. That's all
she really wants us to sleep and be healthier with sleep and not using our phones. But yeah, so this is what they suggest, right? And I have tried it and it just hasn't worked for me.
Yeah. What about you, Christopher? I feel like you're more on the crusade against using your phones too much than almost anybody I know. These things made any difference to you?
It only works if I delete the app. So as much as I'm on Twitter, believe it or not, I have deleted the app off of my phone like years ago. And in addition, I use a little Chrome extension called Simple Blocker to shut things like Twitter off when I want to be really productive. The only thing that works for me, and I admit, I think I'm sort of weak, so I'm maybe a weather vane for these things, just putting the device away or deleting the app. Nothing else works.
Yeah. I mean, so I have this new device that I've been playing with for the last few days. It's called the Palm. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but basically they brought back the Palm brand, even though it has nothing to do with sort of the Palm Pilots of old. And the theory of this little gadget is that it's a phone for when you don't want to use your phone. It runs full Android, but it's smaller and less powerful and can't do as much stuff. And they have this big idea that basically, as best I can tell, the idea is that you will use your phone less if it's less pleasant to use your phone. Like you can load a web browser on this thing, but it kind of sucks to read a web browser on it. So you won't, seems to be the theory behind this whole thing. And I'm sort of torn on the whole premise, especially because this thing is $350. But even this thing where we can still have access to stuff, but it's bad, feels like too much access to things. Like I think you're right, Christopher, that all I've found so far is that the only way anything works is if I just delete it and run away. And then in going and trying to download it again, I can usually stop myself. But anything short of that, I'm just going to end up reading a browser again or looking at Twitter on this crappy phone instead of my big phone. And I don't know that that improves anything.
I mean, it's sort of a sad commentary on human nature. And I think in the future, we should get some behavioral scientists on this podcast. It's just shown that these devices, all of the profit motive, you know, which aligns with engagement metrics, has been to make them more engaging. And it's worked.
Do you have sort of useful tricks other than, you know, deleting these apps? And I now on Fridays will go through and delete a handful of apps and just not look at them again. And then it's super annoying. Monday morning, I go back and like re-download every one of these apps and feel sort of ridiculous. But I have not found a ton that works. Do you guys have good tricks for how you've figured out how to manage this stuff?
Yeah, well, one of them is going to be later on in the podcast. I don't want to ruin that. But for me, and it really goes to what Christopher was saying, which was the behavioral sort of mental psychology around this, is that tricks can only go so far. What's happening is really a lot of the same things around real addiction. And so I've started seeing a psychiatrist about this a couple of months ago when I was working on that screen time piece, because it just felt like, what are the right tools? And my reporting led me to him, and I started talking to him a little bit, and I did two sessions with him. And really those two sessions were the most beneficial to me, because it made me think about why I grabbed that phone, and in the situations that I'm in, how do I try to find something better to do or channel my anxiety towards than the phone in my pocket, because it's just right there.
Yeah. And didn't you also have somebody tell you that they thought your phone was your best friend? I feel like I think about that a lot, and they didn't even say it to me.
Yeah. I mean, they did. And part of the first session was for me, one of the homework assignments that the doctor gave me, which was to go talk to the people in my life, the most important people in my life, about, you know, how they feel like I interact with the phone. Where is it most disruptive to our relationships? And I did that, and I went and talked with people, and, you know, sort of the reporter and me got my notebook out and did all the interviewing. And what I heard back was actually the most impactful. Like, I heard from my mom that my phone is my best friend when I, you know, there are certain parts of the day when I'm hanging out with my mom or when I go see my parents for the weekend. And it made a lot of sense, the things she was saying. And so those became instances where I said to myself, I don't want to be like that in those instances. Again, that's like mind over behavior. Right? We have to sort of shift and say, I'm not going to do that right now. And there are little tricks that we can help ourselves with. Those can either be on the phone, or they can be, you know, physically putting that phone away, not putting it on the table, not being in the room with you. You know, I do that now when I'm with my son in the mornings. I'm just no phone in the room with him. What's interesting about the Palm device, which is, you know, would a small phone being in the room, that isn't going to tempt me, but at least I would be connected, or I'd have a camera. Like, would that be useful? I'm not sure. But it's probably an easier step for some people.
Yeah. Do you buy the idea that this new class of gadgets that's supposed to save us from our other gadgets, like, are these things real? Are they going to work?
I think if it's connected to the internet, it doesn't work. I find that my Kindle keeps me off my phone and has probably improved my life by getting me to read more books. That's been nice. And then on the phone itself, I am very skeptical based on my experience with the Apple Watch, which is like a little phone. Actually, what my watch helps me do is stay connected when I need to be hyper-connected, like when I'm waiting on texts from my editor about some draft I need to turn around. And if I want to have it on me and not have that interruption, just leave it on Do Not Disturb.
Yeah, I've done the same with a camera. You know, when my son was first born, I did not want to be taking photos on my phone, because it would just be, oh, I just took this photo, let me share it with my family, let me make sure it's uploaded to the cloud, all the things that you get distracted with after you do that first thing on the phone. So I bought a Sony camera. And, you know, I try to use that when we are, I don't use it on in all day-to-day experiences, but I try to use it in the moments where I'm like, I don't want to, you know, lead to that next Instagram photo or whatever.
Balance is actually really important. But okay, we should move on. Midterm elections in the U.S. are on Tuesday, which is weirdly more of a tech story than you might think. Because after a crazy couple of years, Facebook and all these other platforms are still trying to reckon with their place in this spread of information and misinformation. So we should talk about political ads and fake news and generally what Facebook is doing now. But first, I'm going to go grab Deepa Seetharaman from our newsroom to come explain all of the literally thousands of things that are happening at Facebook right now. We'll see if Deepa's actually here.
I bet Deepa's
probably
not here.
I bet she's not.
There is not a day that goes by that Facebook is not announcing or doing something that Deepa is not all over. Or she's other times just completely breaking news that Facebook does not know about. And then they're all over it.
Deepa, welcome to Instant Message. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So what I want you to do is in, you know, 15 seconds, describe everything that is happening at Facebook.
It's chaos on every conceivable front.
So thing right now, the midterms. There's this company-wide thing. What are they doing?
They're monitoring activity and trying to figure out all these potential areas of concern. They've told reporters that, yes, this is a war room. Kind of a metaphor. Yeah. They're like constantly in crisis and they need a room to handle all these different challenges.
And I'm curious what you think about this. And you too, Christopher, because you've written about the idea that this sort of backlash against tech is only at the very beginning and is going to get a lot bigger in the sense that people don't trust these companies anymore and that they don't necessarily understand the full grasp of what they're even dealing with, both for users and for the companies themselves. But like, what's your sense of kind of how big this thing is going to get? Like, Facebook just reported earnings. You know, everything is crazy, but they're still making lots of money and they're still growing, which kind of blows my mind. There are more people on Facebook than there used to be. So like how real a problem is this sort of as a company? Christopher, what do you think about this? I mean, you've written a bunch about how this push from users is going to make these companies rethink themselves. Like, do you sense progress or change on that front?
I think definitely you're seeing a lot of progress and change in terms of regulators' view of Facebook, which is what I've been concentrating on. But Deepa, I would really love to hear, you know, user numbers in U.S., and EU net were flat since last quarter. What happened with engagement? Are we seeing any impact in terms of time on site or user behavior from all of this stuff that flows, you know, everything since Cambridge Analytica? Is it having any impact on how, you know, the mass of people use Facebook?
So in the past, Facebook has said it hasn't had a big impact, but they also haven't released numbers. They're talking about this shift going from newsfeed first to stories first. They're not disclosing this information. I mean, it says something that investors are asking me that question.
And it feels like there's been this sense that the things that are going to be most important to Facebook are going to shift away from like what they call the big blue app to Instagram and WhatsApp.
Yes.
And now it increasingly seems like those have their own versions of very much the same problem. Like, you wrote a story about what's been going on in Brazil where WhatsApp is hugely problematic.
Well, WhatsApp is an interesting issue. Nobody but the users can actually see what kind of information is being spread across the platform. Way harder to figure out virality. Can't track if a particularly insidious rumors spreading throughout WhatsApp, and they're manually tracking rumor. It's doctored images.
So, and is this, I mean, all of this is happening at the same time that it seems like Facebook has had this train of important people leave.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask about. I wanted to ask about the real war room at Facebook, which seems to be the room that Mark Zuckerberg is in with all of his other leaders or ex-leaders at this point, and why? Why are they? That room is shrinking, and what's the arguments that he's having with these you know, founders of the companies he acquired, and why are they all leaving?
It's hard to pull a thread through all of them, but with WhatsApp and Instagram, it's a somewhat similar situation where there are strategic disagreements. So Jan Koum and Brian Acton hated the idea of ads in WhatsApp. They weren't happy with the plan to put ads in status, which is the version of stories. Mm-hmm. Instagram, they were used to being completely independent, and they did well by the company. As they become more important, Mark is going to get involved. That contributed to those co-founders leaving. And there have been all these long-time executives who've left, you know, people who've been there for a decade, which is, I mean, it's a It'll be a 15-year-old company in February. So they've been there for most of the company's life. And they're leaving for, I mean, a lot of the excuses are to spend more time with my family, which,
yeah.
Families are cool.
Different issues. They're no longer questions about whether Facebook can do it, right? Like, they were facing all these issues around the IPO, like, can it make money? Can it, you know, negotiate this shift to mobile? And now it's, should Facebook be doing that? Should they be writing code in this way? Should they be launching all these products? Should they be, you know, launching them as quickly as they have been? It's a lot of questions now are about, is the fundamental premise of the company good for the world? So it's in transition.
I think chaos was the right.
Chaos.
Well, Deepa, thank you so much for being here. Before I let you go, Joanna, tell us your upgrade for the week. It has to do with a little bit of what we were talking about before, right? Making your phone worse to make it better.
Yeah, it has to do with turning your phone into an old school newspaper, basically. Turning your phone into something super unexciting, and that is by taking all the color out of your phone and turning on a setting called grayscale mode. And
so the idea is basically that by making it less interesting to look at, you will use it less, right? Like, it's really that simple.
And it works. Like, I am here to tell everyone this is the solution. Okay, it's not really the solution long term. We need to have way better coping skills for how addictive our phones and the services have become. But this really, like, you look at your phone. I mean, everyone can imagine this. You've got all this beautiful color. You've got colorful icons and red trying to grab your attention, notification colors, so many beautiful pictures of food and dogs and babies on Instagram, all in color. But then when you take the color out of it and it's just gray, you really don't want to look at it. You don't really know where to look, too. So your attention isn't being pulled to, oh, that little button or, oh, that app. Especially, like, for me, it works wonders on the Twitter icon because I just don't want to tap that blue and see what's next in my feed. So it works. It works for me. I think everyone should try it, or at least try it for a couple of hours every day so you don't feel you want to go grab that phone and pull you out of the real world. Here's how you do it. I'm going to explain it on iPhones because on Android, every phone is different and the setting could be in different spots. So if you've got an iPhone, you want to go to Settings. You want to go to General. You want to go to Accessibility. And under Accessibility, there should be a line that says Display Accommodations. And there, under Color Filters, the next step is Color Filters, and tap the Grayscale button. Has everyone done it?
And that's it. That just turns it on. Then your phone is gray.
I think I just heard somebody, they did it.
That's amazing. I'm so proud of everybody. And there's one trick to this too, which is also in the accessibility features. You can set it so that if you triple tap the home button, I think, if you click it three times really quickly, it will switch between color and grayscale, which is a thing that I now do all the time.
I do that too. And so thank you, David, for bringing that up. I forgot about that. Since this is so buried, you definitely want to enable this setting. You want to go to accessibility, back to the main accessibility list, and scroll all the way down to the bottom where it says shortcuts, and then go in there and set the shortcut to color filters. And so then when you tap the side button a couple of times, especially if, well, that's on the iPhone 10 or 10S or 10R. If you've got a home button, you've got an old fingerprint sensor model, you can tap on there three times and that will do that.
Awesome. Okay. Well, my phone sucks now, so thank you for that. Joanna, thank you. Coming up next, Clay Bavor and Aparna Chanapragada try to convince me that augmented reality is a real thing and that we might actually all be staring at the world pretty soon through our smartphones.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand?
You hold my hand!
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Over the last couple of years, everybody from Facebook to Apple to Google to Microsoft to Magic Leap to seemingly everyone else won't shut up about augmented reality, the idea of mixing the digital and physical worlds into one thing. But when you hear AR, you probably think of, well, nothing. At most, you think of Pokemon Go, which had everyone in the world staring at the world through their phones for like a couple of weeks. But the tech industry seems to believe that AR is going to be huge.
So we can just be sitting here and we want to play chess. Snap, here's a chessboard and we can play together. You want to watch TV? We can put a digital TV on that wall. And instead of being a piece of hardware, it's a $1 app instead of a $500 piece of equipment. So think about how many of the things that we have in our lives actually don't need to be physical. They can be digital. And think about how much better and more affordable and accessible they're going to be when they are.
That was Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook's F8 conference in 2017. I can't get that idea out of my head. What if, someday, physical objects become totally pointless because everything is digital? It all gets really heady and science fiction-y from there. The big question in the meantime is, what's AR for until then? We're not all getting these crazy glasses soon, but Apple and Google and so many others are already offering the tech that would work with them. So why now? That's what I asked Clay Bavor and Aparna Chennapragada, two VPs at Google working on AR and VR.
One example that I think a lot of people are familiar with is Pokemon Go. You go to a park and you look through the viewfinder of your camera at the park, and overlaid on the park is a digital character from Pokemon. There are more utilitarian uses of it where, for example, if maybe you're moving into a new apartment and you want to figure out what furniture will fit, you could use augmented reality, again, overlaying digital information on top of the world in front of you, to take a 3D model, a virtual representation of maybe a couch you're considering buying, and putting it in place and seeing, does it fit and does it look good?
I feel like that's become like the canonical thing, where it's like whenever you ask somebody about AR, it's either Pokemon Go or put a couch in your living room.
Well, I'll give you a third example. I know you're a relatively recent Californian, but say you're out on a hike and you see some plants you don't recognize. You point your smartphone camera at it and it tells you, oh, that's a California poppy and that's miner's lettuce, overlaid on top of the thing. When you look at what augmented reality can do, we think two interesting things happen. One, you can use it to answer a lot of questions that are just really hard to put into words. Imagine you see an old car. You're like, that's a cool old car. I wonder what it is. And that's
old car rust.
Exactly. Old car with, you know, weird curvy things on the side and pointy mirrors that are silver and it's blue. How do you figure out what that is? Or, oh, that's a weird looking beetle. I wonder what kind of beetle it is. So there's almost literally no search query that would get you back the answer you're looking for.
Fair enough. I had this moment like a week ago. I had to hang a grid of 9 photos on a wall. Some were vertical and some were horizontal. And the like math problem that it became trying to figure out how to hang this grid so that it was correct was insane. And I had this moment where I was like, dear God, if only I could just hold it up and it was like nail here and here and here and then you're fine. It would have been amazing. Can you please hurry and make that for me? Right,
we'll get right on it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And that's what Lens is, right? That's a lot of what you're talking about is the stuff that's possible now, the kind of go search without a search box.
It came kind of born out of like two very practical considerations, right? One is saying, hey, like people are taking a whole bunch of these photos and they want to do more with what they see. Clearly, all these receipts, they're not like just for capturing the memory of a receipt. Yeah. It's to actually like go pay that library fine.
It's the most important receipt of my entire life.
Right.
Yeah.
Or I saw this book at a friend's place or this funky art. Like I want to learn more about it, et cetera. So that's one very clear practical consideration. Let's meet where users are, figure out like how we can kind of build a product that you point to your camera or you take a picture and you can like invoke this tool and it tells you more about it.
That shift is super interesting to me, where you go from saying, you know, tell me about this thing that I'm pointing at. So just like if you cast out whatever 50 years and we're all wearing glasses or contacts or whatever, then are we going to end up with these like crazy impossible trails of information across every atom in the universe as we look at it? The phone can't be the answer forever, right? Like we're not always going to want to hold something up and point it at the thing we're curious about.
It definitely trends that way. And I think augmented reality will live in a variety of devices. 50 years out is awfully hard to see,
fair.
Right? If you remember 50 years ago, I think we were not yet on the moon. We had not let yet. The first packets had not been sent over ARPANET, the precursor to the internet.
Right, 15 years out then.
So 15 years out, you want to visualize kind of a vignette from the future. Imagine you're walking down the street in San Francisco and you're looking out onto the street and maybe looking for some place to have a meal. First of all, you're going to know exactly where you are, and there's going to be the most visible, helpful virtual street signage or even a guide just taking you where you're going. Maybe a friendly fox or something like that leading the way. And overlaid on the restaurants, it might be their reviews and comments and knowledge about whether one or more of your friends have gone there. And your guide will lead the way there, and then you'll sit down, and your technology will know that actually now you're enjoying a meal, and just quiet everything down and go enjoy your meal.
That's fair. So, what do you guys think about the sort of social side of this? Like, on the one hand, you know, you watch a bunch of people hold up their phones and run around a table playing a game together, and it seems sort of ridiculous. But on the other hand, I played a ton of Pokemon Go, and it was awesome, and it totally worked. Like, how does, once we all start to use this stuff, how do we use it together? Like, what does that look like? I think one worry I hear from people is that all this tech is going to be really isolating, and we're just going to exist in our own bubble where even the actual world looks different to every individual person.
I think fundamentally, anytime you have these shifts, you will have a single player mode and a multiplayer mode, if you will, right? So one of the things you think about is, hey, like if we had AR, what are some single player use cases, right? Uses of this. So you kind of like walk into a store, imagine you're staring at a shelf full of like, I don't know, cereal, and you're like, which one's gluten-free? And then it just like everything else disappears and you're kind of getting that useful information there. So there'll be a bunch of, we think, the single player use cases. But I think, to your point, I think there's like really big opportunity in terms of this almost like paint the world together with data and experience kind of opportunity here. So for that, at least at Google, we've been saying, look, let 1,000 flowers bloom here. Let people create these experiences. So with our platform, right, with our developer platform in Android, we call it AR Core, we're saying, hey, like how can we have a shared experience here? That is, let's say, like, literally, if you draw a line here, how can, you know, Shannon like add some more? How can like David add? How can like Clay add some more to it? How do you kind of collectively, collaboratively create this experience? In fact, we had this like almost ridiculously simplistic app called Just a Line. It's not meant to be like a runaway, like, you know, consumer hit. It was supposed to illustrate saying if all you could do was like draw a line on the and anchor it to the world, and you could do it and I could do it, like what can you create, right? What art can you create in the world?
One of the analogies we think about is kind of Wikipedia, but for the physical world. So you have all of these smart people making Wikipedia better and better by contributing ideas, knowledge, refinements, edits, and so on. Imagine that in time anyone out and about in the world could improve the world in some small way by leaving behind a helpful hint, a helpful tip, a piece of art, something, some bit of creative inspiration, and imagine that playing forward on a world scale. I think some pretty interesting things come from that.
Okay, makes sense. And that's our show. Thanks to Clay, Aparna, Deepa, Joanna, and Christopher for being here. And thank you for listening. We have new shows weekly on Fridays, so make sure you subscribe to Instant Message on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, send us feedback and ideas at personaltech@wsj.com. We'll talk to you next week.